And right now, I'm joined on the phone by Leila El Haddad. She's a journalist based in the United States in the Gaza Strip. We're going to be talking about the situation there. Israel sent troops and tanks into Gaza last Wednesday after Palestinian fighters seized Corporal Gilad Shalit in a cross-border raid last Saturday. Those holding the corporal have demanded that Israel release hundreds of jailed Palestinians before they will free him. Israel has refused and has launched airstrikes against the main Gaza power plant and road bridges. Israeli fighter jets have been bombing in Gaza and the West Bank, and the Israeli army has been shelling Gaza. Much of Gaza, including two main hospitals, is without power and water, and 1.4 million residents of Gaza are days away from a humanitarian crisis, according to the UN aid chief. Israeli forces have arrested up to 32 Palestinian MPs in the West Bank and are holding them in jail. Israel threatened on Friday night to kill Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh if Hamas militants do not release a captured Israeli soldier unharmed. This threat was delivered in a letter to Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas as Israel debated a deal offered by Hamas to free Corporal Gilad Shalit. On Saturday, Israel's Air Force attacked the office of the Palestinian Prime Minister. He was not in his office at the time of the helicopter strike. And right now we're joined by Leila El Haddad to talk about the developments in the Gaza Strip. Again, she's a journalist based in the U.S. in the Gaza Strip. She's a regular contributor to The Guardian Unlimited and is a correspondent for Al Jazeera's English language website. Her blog, Raising Youssef, A Diary of a Mother Under Occupation, is named after her two-year-old son. Hello, Leila, can you hear me?
I can.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Leila.
Pleasure.
So can you bring us up to date? It's Sunday, July 2nd. Can you bring us up to date on the situation in Gaza right now?
Well, the situation is, you know, as you mentioned, very, very worrying and distressing. I've been keeping in touch with family and friends there, getting updates from them just to see how the situation is affecting them on the ground. When I left Gaza last month, the most worrying part of what was going on was the fact that due to constant, and after the elections, but before this most recent escalation, and it was at a time when there was continuous border closures of the only commercial crossing, and there were food shortages, and you know we were having to line up to get our flour and our bread. And just as I was leaving, things were escalating internally, a lot of tensions between the rival factions. And, you know, the money wasn't coming in, and the employees weren't being paid for the third month in a row. And so that was the main concern. And now, of course, what's happening, as you mentioned, with the recent capture of the soldier and then Israel cutting off electricity on pretty much all of Gaza's residents, most of its residents at least. And as a result, the water is also cut off because, of course, the wells pump the water through electricity. And so people I've been talking to, my aunts and my cousins and my friends, have been telling me all of their food has spoiled because, of course, the electricity is only being distributed through generators run by the government for 3 hours at a time in each district. In those 3 hours, for example, my aunt, who's a physician in a hospital in northern Gaza and also a community activist, just is able to recharge her laptop so she can kind of continue with her work. Otherwise, all of their food has gone bad. And you can imagine that stores, of course, supermarkets, etc., all of their supplies have gone bad. Also, pharmacies are running on empty now. And, of course, biggest concern to the hospitals and the kidney dialysis machines and the chemotherapy and all those kind of things. In addition to the basic things for children like vaccines and whatnot, and of course there being no clean water, very little clean water in Gaza, and so all of this is really in every. I mean, if we were saying it was nearing a humanitarian crisis before, with no money and no salaries being paid to a third of the Palestinian population, now it really is suddenly, almost overnight, has become a humanitarian crisis, and the worry is there is no outlet. You know, in other situations, there's people flee. The natural result of wars is that refugees are created. Well, in this case, you're having internal refugees and internal displacement, and all of the borders are completely sealed off. I mean, I myself now have become effectively a refugee, me and my son, because if we wanted to, chose to go back at this very moment, I couldn't. You know, my passport's Palestinian Authority. That's where my home is and my family. Now I can't go back because the Rafah crossing, which is the only crossing in and out of Gaza for all of the residents there, 1.5 million people, which was manned after the Israeli disengagement last summer by Palestinians and Egyptians, but ultimately was still controlled by Israel through radio, through remote surveillance, rather. Now that has been sealed off to everyone. And so there is really no escaping what is happening now in Gaza.
Now, you say people's food is spoiling, that there's no water, no running water, no electricity in Gaza at the moment. If people's food, if their food is spoiling, I imagine that it's not possible for them to go out and get more, partly because of the shelling and the attacks that are going on. But also, I imagine the food's probably spoiling in the stores as well because they don't have power either.
Yes, absolutely. As I mentioned, I mean, it's not just impacting individual homes. It's impacting, you know, entire neighborhoods and the towns and cities because the supermarkets have no method of preserving the food. I mean, it's funny. We're so used to, you know, when we think of the electricity cutting off, maybe we think of our televisions and our radios. We don't think of these other things. And we certainly don't think of it in a way that's prolonged. And now they're saying it may last a minimum of 3 months or more. You know, when I was there, the electricity was certainly cut off. There's all of our electricity is controlled and generated by Israeli plants because they've denied us the ability to have our own power plants and whatnot. So we're subject to their rates and so on. But and it would cut off certainly maybe for 8 hours at a time maximum. But this is cutting off for days and weeks and months at a time now. And so, yes, they can't. They're running on what stocks they have in their houses. And, you know, neighbors are helping each other. And the commercial crossing also is not open systematically. I believe it opened for a few hours, but in those few hours, you can bring in limited supplies to feed 1.4 million people, of course. And we're talking about a population here where 70% of the people are under the poverty line, living under $2 a day. So you can imagine that they don't really have the means anyhow to be able to sustain themselves. And so really in every sense of the word, no matter what you think about the capture, no matter what, all of this that's going on is collectively punishing the people in every sense of the word.
What has been the international reaction to this assault on Gaza?
The international reaction, I mean, it's, you know, the American reaction is sort of follows the usual pattern of immediately jumping to Israel's defense and Israel's right to defend herself and to do anything it must to regain its soldier. International reaction, and you know, in recent days saying that now the Gaza, the representatives that have been detained without charge, which is very important to mention, almost half of them, I believe, that they must be released. But of course, no mention at all of the some 9,000 Palestinian prisoners, many also detained without charges, many children and women, in Israeli jails under deplorable conditions for a very long time. And if you count the number of Palestinians that have been detained in Israeli jails since 1967, it constitutes 20% of the population. So that's saying something like the equivalent of 60 million Americans would have been imprisoned. So far the international reaction kind of mellow. Considering the humanitarian impact of what's going on, I would have expected an outcry. Not this kind of wishy-washy, you know, well, let's get back to the negotiating table. Let's see what we can do to secure the release of this one soldier, you know. So it's a little distressing to me that people are, I mean, already they were asphyxiating from the financial and the economic and the political blockade, and now they have no electricity and water, and everyone is kind of just saying our hands are tied.
So what would you say to folks who would say, well, you know, if the militants that are holding the soldier would just release him, then all this would end, the siege would end, and people could, their lives could go back to normal. So it's not Israel's fault, it's these militants that are holding the soldier. And I think part of the idea behind this assault is the thinking that maybe there would be pressure from the Palestinian people to on these militants to release this soldier. What do you think of that reasoning?
I mean, regardless of, as I mentioned before, thoughts about the capture of the soldier, keeping in mind from a humanitarian legal perspective, the attack against the military base is actually considered legal based on international law. But that aside, I mean, Israel's obligation and priority to return their soldier should not mandate that 1.4 million people be subject to these sorts of punitive measures that are affecting their everyday life, that are will soon, if they haven't already, be killing children and women and, you know, all sort affecting civilians in the most extreme way. This is just completely and utterly illegitimate. And I mean, it should not be happening no matter what the circumstances. And I think, in a sense, many people saw this attack as inevitable, as a matter of time, and the soldiers' capture was just sort of the trigger, if you will. It was reported in Haaretz that actually Israeli intelligence knew there was a tunnel, and they had exerted minimal effort to try to actually destroy that tunnel or find it, because it would have provided them with just the excuse they needed to attack Gaza and undermine the government and then topple this current government that they've been trying everything they can do along with the United States to see it come to an end, including the U.S. government financing rival faction Fatah, $11 million, in an effort initially to stave off their election win and then to just kind of fund coercive forces to try to undermine it. So it's, I mean, I see it as part of this, you know, grand plan to undermine this government, part of including the political and economic blockade. So it doesn't surprise me.
Gush Shalom, an Israeli peace group, sent out a number of press releases about the situation, and one of them they say, quote, "The term kidnapped soldier, current in the Israeli media and the speeches of government speakers, is highly misleading. The soldier captured by the other side's fighters in the course of a battle is a prisoner of war and should be considered so." What do you think of that statement by Gush Shalom?
I mean, I agree. I've heard that word, kidnapping, used on numerous occasions. I mean, this is a conscripted soldier and certainly not a civilian. And so I think it is an accurate statement. Now, I understand you're speaking later with the director of human rights, Mark, and I know him, and I've spoken to him a number of occasions. He would tell you, I think, if I understood him correctly, I was in another program with him, that actually he would be considered a hostage because the other side is making demands. But irregardless, it's definitely not, I think, a kidnapping. It is very misleading, as if it was a very sort of malicious act against an innocent youth, or, you know, which it wasn't. And, of course, to me, it's just bewildering that there's all this enormous amount of energy being expended to secure his release when similar attention or energy is not devoted to getting back to the negotiating table, to really solving this problem at its core by giving Palestinians their freedom to live and to move and to be able to unite the West Bank and Gaza and to have a viable state with a capital. If half of the fraction of this energy was expended, perhaps we wouldn't be in this situation today. Not to mention, of course, that there is no mention of, as I'm, the 9,000 Palestinian prisoners that were really kidnapped from their homes, often from their very beds at night, and taken without being explained to what they did and what their charges were. Oftentimes, children, the charges that would be leveled against them would be something like stone throwing, for example. And no attention, of course, or minimal attention given to that in the worldwide media.
How many of these prisoners are the militants that are holding the Israeli corporal? How many of the prisoners are they demanding should be released? Only the ones that are being held without charge, or do you know the details on that?
Initially, I believe they had demanded that children and women be released. And I think the most recent thing that I heard was 1,000 prisoners be released. So it seems to me there may be more than one group involved here. And it certainly isn't clear who exactly is in charge. And there was this new group with a new name also, which indicates, and it's not surprising because they're recently post-election and in the face of this constant blockade and lack of money and food insecurity, which leads to physical insecurity, you certainly saw a lot of new factions emerging, and that has come to characterize, I think, post-disengagement in Gaza. But so recent, their most recent demand is the release of 1,000 prisoners. I'm not sure if, I mean, it would seem to me they certainly didn't mention names, like any kind of high-ranking figures. So I'm guessing what they were demanding, based on their initial demand, is the ones that are the most detained based on no charges whatsoever, and the most innocent of them all, of course, and the children, and so on.
So there's 9,000 Palestinian prisoners currently being held in Israeli jails, as you mentioned, most being held without charges. And many times that's done with using what's called administrative detention. Can you talk about that?
Basically, it's a relic of British mandate rule in Palestine. And what it entails is detaining someone without charge for a certain amount of time, for example, 30 days, and that can be extended it can be continually extended, basically, without sort of an expiration on the number of times this person can be detained. So 30 days, and then it can be extended for another 30 days to 60 days to 120 days. And a person can literally spend maybe their entire lives in this manner, without court date, without trial. And another thing I should mention is that there's no law in Israel that actually stipulates the rights of prisoners or governs the whole detention and imprisonment of Palestinians. So many can be imprisoned in very tiny cells, subject to a position, torture, and other kinds of treatment because there is no law that stipulates those things are illegal.
Go into a little more detail, if you would, about some of the conditions that Palestinian prisoners are held under in Israeli jails.
Yes, I mean, every year, I think it's April 16th, it's Palestinian Prisoners' Day, and tens of thousands of families of prisoners, the women are particularly active in Gaza, go out in the streets carrying pictures of their imprisoned family members and, you know, young children also, whom have never seen their fathers. There's entire generations that have grown up without seeing their mothers or fathers who are in detention or jail, will go out and protest in the streets demanding their release. And they get minimal visitation through the Red Cross, and of course they can't oftentimes take things with them. I know one case, for example, who needed his reading glasses, and they wouldn't allow those through. As I mentioned, because there's no law that that governs the conditions or their rights, oftentimes they can be imprisoned in very, very tiny cells, just literally enough for their bodies, and subject to all kinds of what's known as position torture, meaning they can be tied to a chair, their hands tied to the back of a chair and pushed forward, or made to stand, for example, on their knees for hours at a time in interrogations. And this happens as well in detention, administrative detention, probably more than it happens in jail, actually, as well as even before the period of administrative detention, often when they'll be raided into towns and cities such as Rafah. I've spoken to many people that have told me, you know, they'll all be holed up in one room, an entire family, and then if someone makes a peep, that person will be taken out and exposed to position torture, made to stand for example, 3 or 4 hours at a time with their hands behind their back and on their knees. So these are very common practices, and it's all governed by this sort of code of ambiguity where there's no rule that tells you what's wrong and what's right, so you can get away with a lot and you won't have to report to your superiors about it. And it's very well documented in Israeli human rights organizations such as Beit Salem and others.
I'm speaking with Leila.
And of course, that's in addition to the sanitary conditions, and the medical conditions are very poor as well.
The medical conditions and the sanitary conditions are very poor? Okay. I'm speaking with Leila El Haddad. She's a journalist based in the U.S. in the Gaza Strip. We're talking about the situation in Gaza right now. I just have a few minutes left, Leila. I'm wondering if you could tell me what you think of the media coverage. Are you in the U.S. right now? And what do you think of the U.S. media coverage?
I've been on the East Coast for about a month now. It's when I first came here, I still am very shocked. I mean, even though I studied here, and it's been several years since I was back, and my husband, of course, is a medical resident here, and he's a Palestinian refugee, so he can't come join me in Gaza. He's not allowed by Israel to even to cross through the Rafah crossing, even after disengagement. So I have to commute back and forth with our son. And I came back, and I mean, immediately, it's, you know, even, let's not even speak about the local channels, which, of course, will give you the weather and the traffic and, you know, whose dog died on what street and what street is unsafe and why this road bump was put on this street and it wasn't on that street. And, you know, you'll be lucky if you'll get some major event that's happening. And even if you're speaking about cable channels, CNN and Fox News and MSNBC, I mean, they spent the good part of the day yesterday talking about whether or not the weather would allow for the launch of Discovery. And I understand that's very important, but to spend, you know, whatever it was, 13 hours with a million different correspondents talking about every aspect of the weather and then snippets, you know, maybe 5-10 seconds about what happened in Baghdad and what's going on in Gaza, and then back again. I mean, so, I mean, to me, it's not surprising that there's very little information or very little knowledge, I think, amongst the mainstream population here about what's happening, or at least very accurate knowledge, because what information is coming through the media is very biased and very skewed and very misinformed. And even the way it's covered is, the information is provided in a disproportionate manner. For example, you'll notice if you follow the trends that an Israeli child's death is covered something like 20 times more than a Palestinian child's death would be. And so all of these things, I think, are very telling. And maybe often, I think, journalists, and they may be not doing it intentionally. Certainly sometimes they would be, but they fall into these patterns and trends that they think they're accurately covering. And I think when presented with the details of how exactly the coverage is coming through, many of them are often surprised, which is why it's important to continue and monitor and speak out. And so I think the same applies to a lot of the people, is that they really, unless you actively are going out to search for the information and get informed through the internet or through alternative media sources, that information is not going to reach you. That's my sense. It's much, much more difficult to stay well informed in a fair and accurate manner about what's happening over there.
I just have one final question for you, Leila, today. You've said recently that the lesson to be learned out of all of this is that the policy of unilateralism as practiced by Israel can never succeed in achieving a just and secure peace for all. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yes. I mean, since a couple of years ago, former Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon had begun this, what would become his so-called legacy of unilateralism, meaning enacting, carrying through policies unilaterally without consulting or negotiating with the Palestinians. And that the manifestation of that, the largest manifestation, was the disengagement from Gaza, which basically was not an end of the occupation. It simply made the occupation more sophisticated. It made sure that there was no harm to the Israelis. So they were taken out, Israeli settlers, who, of course, were living there illegally, as well as the troops that were protecting them. They were removed from Gaza, but they continued to surround Gaza. They continued to close the borders and control the air and the border crossings and even the permit entry and exit system and the birth registration. So we still had zero sovereignty. In fact, the conditions were worse than before because we were completely isolated and cut off from the West Bank. And so yet it was a much lauded period and policy, because, you know, here Ariel Sharon, the warrior, the bulldozer, was making this courageous move to withdraw from Gaza, when in reality it was a policy, a very selfish policy that only served Israeli interests, if at all, and did not attempt to solve the deep-seated, rooted problem. It was almost like leaving Gaza to the wolves. I mean, it was just solving it from one side, for one side's interests, and not caring or thinking about the consequences of the other side. And that's why I say it can never, it's a Band-Aid solution. It can never achieve a long-term just peace. You're going to see the same thing happen in the West Bank with this so-called convergence plan, which will annex a good portion of the West Bank and cut it into 9 separate cantons. And that's it, within the West Bank itself, of course, the West Bank being cut off from Gaza. And we're going to see the same sorts of things happening there, I think, once that plan takes place, which again was celebrated, the Bush administration celebrated that and encouraged Olmert for that move.
I said that would be my last question. This is going to be my last question. Sorry. So if that is not the path to peace or the solution, what do you think would be a better approach?
Well, it's getting back to the negotiating table, and critics will say, well, we have no negotiating partner with this terrorist government, but I say every government seems to be a terrorist government to the Israelis. I mean, there is never a partner in the Palestinians, whether that was Arafat, and after him, Mahmoud Abbas, who was, of course, still a president and still very willing to speak peace and negotiate. And yet in 2003, Sharon made a huge, enormous effort when he came here to visit President Bush with the sole purpose of trying to convince him that Abbas was not a partner for peace. And it's just cyclical. I mean, we see the same things happening again and again. Of course, with the Hamas government, it's much easier for Israel to make that claim. The reality is it's always been the case that there's never been a partner. And I think there is a partner if the Israelis just take that step forward. It would be, I think, in everyone's interest, and it would save a lot of lives and prevent a lot of bloodshed and result in a more secure and stable Middle East. And so we need to get back to the negotiating table. And not this sort of incremental kind of thing that was going on in the 90s with Oslo that was basically a smokescreen for the continuation of the occupation. We need real negotiation, and we need Israel to completely end its occupation of Gaza and the West Bank, allow for a viable Palestinian state with sovereignty, and, of course, with East Jerusalem as the capital, and very importantly, resolve the refugee crisis and allow for the right of return or compensation of the Palestinian refugees.
I've been speaking with Leila El-Haddad. She's a journalist based in the U.S. in the Gaza Strip. She's a regular contributor to The Guardian Unlimited and is a correspondent for Al Jazeera's English language website. Her blog, Raising Youssef, A Diary of a Mother Under Occupation, is named after her two-year-old son. Thank you so much for joining me today, Leila. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care.